Welcome to KBOO, Jacob Reisberg.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, you've most recently worked as a legislative legal advisor for the New York City Council and were active as a law student around a number of social justice issues, including racism and police violence. More recently, this year, you worked to provide criminal defense representation in North Dakota for the Water Protector Legal Collective. And so we look forward to hearing a report on that work. First, why don't you explain a bit about the Water Protector Legal Collective, what they do and how they were formed?
Sure. So the Water Protector Legal Collective was formerly known as Red Owl, and it's been a couple different things at different times. So for a while, the Water Protector Legal Collective was the sort of group of lawyers who were in camp at Standing Rock while the camps were still standing and populated and hadn't been evicted by the police. And at that point, they were doing things like providing jail support or providing training, providing help for folks to give them information about what to do if they were arrested. Now that camps have been evicted, it sort of shifted to a slightly different mode. Now the Water Protector Legal Collective has a civil branch which is working to bring civil claims on behalf of water protectors to try to get some repense for excessive use of force, things like that. I didn't work with that arm. I instead worked with the criminal defense branch. And there the mission is to provide free legal support for anyone who's facing criminal charges for their activism at Standing Rock.
And the stakes are higher and consequences more daunting. So would you set the scene for us of what it was like there at Standing Rock when you arrived? Clearly there's much to mourn in the loss of the losses of the protests and the pipeline being completed and on one level kind of rolling over that brave and important protest and also how much it inspired people around the world. But there's a lot still standing at Standing Rock. And yes. What was the situation? What was the scene when you arrived?
So I got there, it certainly was inspiring, and it was inspiring enough for me to quit my job in New York and move out to North Dakota. And I got there in March, about a month after the final eviction. The final eviction in camp was in late February when the National Guard and police finally said to everyone who was still there, you have to leave or we're going to arrest you, and that's what they did. But when I got there to a situation where despite the fact that folks were no longer in camp, despite the fact that the pipeline was completed and that oil began to flow basically in the first month that I was there, the state of North Dakota was still pursuing criminal charges, criminal cases against a large number of water protectors, over 850 separate cases by the time that I got there.
And these were arrests that had happened last fall. Some of them were mass arrests. And over a period of several months. Can you say something about those arrests?
Absolutely. I mean, there were sort of waves of arrests happening from the very beginning of the start of the resistance at Standing Rock to the very end. And sometimes it would be one or two a day, just sort of individual folks picked off by the police. On certain days, there were these huge mass arrests with sometimes groups of 20, 30, up to 130 people being arrested all at once.
And recently, some of those cases have been thrown out by the judge because they don't meet, I assume, the normal requirements of the law. Can you say a little about that? And what is there a different bar for these? Clearly, these are political arrests, and there is both the demonstration of their power on the scene and the discourse around it, but then they may have a different fate in the courts.
Absolutely. And I think it might be helpful if I read to you an arrest report, which is pretty representative of, I think, a lot of these mass arrests. This is an arrest report written by a police officer of my client, who I won't name, but I'll just refer to her as grandmother. She's a woman in her 70s who's a Native woman with family from South Dakota. And this is the entirety of the basis for her arrest. So grandmother was in a teepee on a DAPL site. Grandmother was arrested for criminal trespass and inciting a riot after refusing to leave. Grandmother and others locked arms together to delay being arrested. There were well over 200 people at the unlawful protest. And that's it. That's the entire basis that the police officer states for arresting this person. And then that's the basis that the prosecutor then decides, yes, I am affirmatively going to continue to bring criminal charges against these people.
So the prosecutor used that police report to move it forward to criminal charges. And clearly there's both the arrogance of the arresting officer, but then the prosecutor can decide, right? There's a lot of latitude in whether to press criminal charges. And that seems like quite a cynical as well as an arrogant and oppressive move.
It's hard to understand from the perspective of someone who sort of sees what happened at Standing Rock as a righteous cause, as a righteous resistance. I asked, and several of our attorneys asked the prosecutor at various stages, why are you doing this? And the response was, my community was terrorized. And I think that's a truthful statement from his perspective, but it sort of shows you how wide the gap is between where we're coming from.
Yeah, and how elastic the term terrorism is. And there's a long history of that, of one person's social justice movement resistance is another's act of terrorism. What about the deal now that these protesters are being offered? Because, of course, the courts often offer pleas, and that itself is something we followed on the show over time, the corrupting aspect of all these pleas. What pleas are being offered the protesters?
So essentially the same exact plea is being offered in almost every case. The prosecutor has said to water protectors, if you don't want to come back to North Dakota, if you want to settle this right now, we will let you take sort of the charge of your choice and give you what's called a deferred imposition of a sentence, which means so long as you are not arrested or potentially convicted in the next year, this charge will vanish in a year. So it's as if nothing had ever happened, but the state of North Dakota will keep your bond money as fines and fees. So depending on what you were bonded out for, the state of Dakota keeps that money. So there's both a financial incentive for the state and the prosecutors to be pushing these deals, but there's also a sort of narrative, control of the narrative or control of some sort of potentially moral victory that's at stake there, where if folks take that deal and say, yes, I'm guilty, and I had a lot of clients who basically said, I'm never going to stay that because I don't believe I was guilty of anything. But from the state of North Dakota's perspective, they then get to claim, look, these folks admitted to committing a crime, therefore our use of force was justified, and therefore, importantly, they can't sue us down the road for whatever civil claims they want to bring.
So what are the stakes for the defendants in these criminal cases, which some of which are felonies and serious, some have federal charges that involve very serious federal cases? Can you say something about the different stakes for the protesters who've been filed under criminal charges?
Absolutely, although I want to then mention something about felonies, because that term sometimes has scary connotations, and I think it's important to take a closer look of what that actually means. Of the 850 cases I mentioned, only 50 or so of those are felony cases. The rest are all misdemeanors, things like trespass, things like refusing to follow a safety order, things of that nature. So relatively low stakes. Felonies do have sort of inherently higher stakes because of some of the collateral consequences that they can have. But if you actually look at what the underlying actions are that the state is alleging constitute those felonies, it becomes a lot less scary. And I think it's useful to try to interrogate why the word felony sort of conjures up scary thoughts for most people. But for example, the most recent felony case that just went to trial a few days ago was a case in which an individual was flying a drone above a resistance site and sort of monitoring with the drone what the police were doing, filming what was going on, doing documentary filmmaking. And this individual was charged with felony reckless endangerment for flying the drone. And the accusation was he was flying it in a way that could be extremely dangerous.
What is the Water Protector Legal Collective position on this, just in closing, and then maybe just say a bit about some of the other activism going on around these legal cases in closing today, and we'll continue to follow this going forward.
Our position is that all of these cases should be dismissed, and this drone case that I mentioned actually was given not guilty on all counts, so that's a good outcome there. Going forward, we are looking for legal support and assistance. So especially if there are any attorneys, paralegals, or just sort of eager volunteers, if you want to look at our Facebook or website, you can just Google Water Protector Legal. We also have a companion organization called the Freshet Collective that's doing amazing legal support work and support work for arrestees. So look them up as well. I think they're hiring too.
Well, thank you, Jakob Reisberg, for your work and for joining us here today on the Olmol Variety Hour. And we look forward to continuing to support it whatever way we can, and including periodic field reports. Thanks so much
thank
for being
you.
With us.
Through our voice, the world knows there's no choice. We're making save the children. Who just don't understand.